When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, everyone, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about, you guessed it, board games. Today, we're going to talk about the games we played this week, the news and why it doesn't matter, and the game of the week, which is called Wilmot's Warehouse.
So, what'd you play last week?
Well, let's get this one out of the way, Mark, because it's divisive. This is a game called Terminus, designed by Earl Aspris and Tom Volpa, and published by Inside Up Games. And in this game, you are sort of developing a city while building a subway through said city. And it is a game that I will say is best taught by telling the players the victory conditions, because all the victory points are at the end of the game. And it makes no sense. The game will make no sense what you're doing if you don't understand why you're doing it. And so you're putting out developments, you're building track, trying to get stations around these developments, and there's straight up points for that in every game. And then randomly in each game, there are three projects that you can put lobbyists to. And then you have your own personal agendas that you can also get points for.
All of which revolve around stops and hubs and stations being put in various places anyway. So at the end of the day, it's mostly about having as many stations and stops as possible in the right places.
True. And it's very much a resource management game. Because you need to have all your ducks in a row in order to place these tracks and stations using one action. And then you have to use several hundred different actions to get all the stuff you need to do that particular action.
Yes.
And hoping that the resources are going to be there, because it uses this interesting fluctuating market, but not in a good way of collecting those resources. I very much enjoyed it. It has a lot of sort of moving parts and you have the plan ahead. I don't think we played it. We played it at the full five-player count, and I think that added to a little bit of the chaos. I think there'll still be chaos at four, but it might be a little bit manageable with a lower player count. Who knows? It's very restrictive in that way, because at five, it's chaotic. Four, three, maybe, because once you get down to two or one, then there's a whole other subset of rules that you have to bring in to manage the resources after that. Mark, what did you think of Terminus?
I agree that it would be better with three or four. I did not enjoy Terminus much at all. I do appreciate it when a medium-heavy Euro has relatively focused scoring, and that part was fine. I think it was the best part of Terminus, frankly, because the market fluctuations were borderline infuriating. So as you say, in order to build things, you need all your ducks in a row. Most actions you take require the combination of a variety of different resources. And if it were just a function of managing action scarcity to get all those things together and just to be as efficient as possible, that would have been one thing. The problem is that there is a market for resources, and you nominally want to get to those resources first. There's kind of a rondelle mechanism where you can go as far as you want around the rondelle, but you can only go around the rondelle three times per round. So there's this efficiency versus comprehensiveness tension. And I very much appreciate it when rondelles work on that basis. No, Antica has some of the same tension, albeit in a different way. But the overall tempo considerations are completely wrecked by the way the market works. Because, yeah, maybe I want to get to that market right quick, right away, because I want to get to those resources before anyone else can, and I'll get the cheaper price. But then sometimes people exogenously just spend the resource on their turn, or even just discard them because they ran out of room because you're available inventory space is so parsimonious. And now there's cheap resources available on the market for no earthly reason. So the person who goes last and who's just been going every little step along the rundel falls into cheap resources. It's bad enough when it comes to the money. When it comes to the one resource that is acquired, one of the resources, but one of the actual traditional resources that is acquired not through money, it is a million times worse. The way that it works is a million, perhaps is a bit of an exaggeration. Let's say several hundred thousand times worse. Okay. I don't want to commit to a million. Yeah, but several hundred thousand. Yeah, it's pretty high. I agree. It's called construction. It's represented by little cones. It's all about the cones. And when you go to acquire cones, you take everything in the leftmost column that has any cones in it. So if there's one cone there, you get one cone. If there's four cones there, you get four cones. Four cones is a good amount of cones. One cone is a bad amount of cones. Now, in theory, if you get there sooner, the larger columns will be stocked and you'll get more. That part is fine. If it was a pure tempo consideration, I got there last, I get fewer cones, whatever. But maybe it's the case that you're the first to get there, but somebody just went and spent two cones to do a build action somewhere. So instead of getting three cones, you get one. And that's your reward for getting there first. Now, anyway, it's LOL, but just slow walk things. You can't. If you're right next to that space, you're going to have to bypass it or do something even worse. All of this conjoins in a situation where, as we said, the scoring is almost all about setting out stops. In order to set out stops, you need four resources all at the same time to do the thing. All the while managing the chaos of these fluctuating markets. There are lots of euros that do fluctuating markets well. I'm not a huge fan of Power Grid. Power Grid does a pretty good job of handling market fluctuation. I would point to Matt Gert's Navigador as an excellent, very approachable, rules-light market manipulation euro where you actually have these tension trade-offs. Like, well, I want to do the maximally efficient thing. Oh, but the market's ripe for me to go capitalize on this. Terminus fails in both respects. Number one, because the tempo is all over the place, so it comes off as purely arbitrary and frustrating. And number two, it's not even that you can capitalize on all the contours of a market, even in comparatively more sophisticated but rules light games like Navigador. If it's the case that power is in really high demand and there's no power available on the market, and you look down at your board, you've got a bunch of power, there's nothing you can do about that. Just you happen to have some power and nobody else can get any power.
I suppose if you could sell back at a high price.
Precisely. If you could sell it, if there were trading involved, who knows, there'd be something. I literally don't think that the market manipulation adds anything of substance to the game. It just makes things more chaotic and occasionally frustrating because there are these bottlenecks, these hard bottlenecks. The only resource where you're not subjected to these hard bottlenecks is your own track. Your own track, you just go and buy at fixed rates. And the more you buy at a time, the cheaper it gets, you get a bulk discount. That part's fine. And it dovetails with the scarcity of money and the scarcity of action. Like, when it's just doing normal Euro stuff, Terminus is fine. But the utter chaos and weirdness of the market manipulation, coupled with the fact that you need so many different kinds of resources to get anywhere, led me to feel that it was incredibly tedious and frustrating.
Sure, and you said there was a cap on how many you could have. I just want to make sure people understand how hard that cap is.
Oh, yeah.
What is it, like 8 or 10?
It's 10.
10. So 10 resources.
Given that you need all of them
at
any given time, and the place where you spend those resources tends to be the spot just before it on the rondel where you... So in other words, I get the resource in turn one. If I want to spend that same resource one turn later, I have to go all the way around the rondel and give up a third of my round to do so. So you're just sitting around with all these resources, and maybe you went and bought them because they were cheap at the time, and you never know when they're going to be cheap again because the market's so unpredictable. So you end up with just sitting with all these things lying around, which in turn paralyzes the market and doesn't lead to your getting a competitive advantage over other players. It just leads to the game stalling in unsatisfying ways.
A couple of other interesting things that I enjoyed. Like we said, it's a rondel. We have some stops, but there's some sort of paths leading around to all the different actions. So some stops, some actions, you can do it two different stops because of the way the little paths work, which I thought was interesting. The other thing, like I said, you put out developments to, you know, improve the city, and those also will give people that have lobbyists on them different actions that they can do. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, anyway. That was cool. And the ones that allowed you to bypass the incredibly restrictive resource market system were very much advantageous and gave a little bit of grist and a little bit of fluidity to Terminus. And frankly, after I had a couple of those in the bag, I felt like I was finally able to make any progress as opposed to before where I just felt like I was floundering.
Well, like I said, basic progress in Terminus is putting out tracks and stations. And in order to do that, first you need to improve your station capacity because you can't put out stations. Oh,
I forgot about
the
that
game.
Part. Jeez,
so first you have to put out station capacity, which is going to cost you construction and maybe some power. And then you're going to have to make sure you have enough track. And then, like you said, you have to start, you know, getting those four different resources you need to even take the place track action.
Yes.
So that's just to get the one step of progress at the beginning. And then it's just sort of doing that. I don't want to say doing that over and over again because it sounds repetitive. Anyway. If you're interested at all, there is a 99% chance that we are streaming that this coming Saturday. So
yes, Warm Boy has indicated some interest. And I have to say, like, if you're interested in these kinds of hyper-efficient, restricted resource euros, I don't understand why the market fluctuation adds value to that kind of perspective. It's a baffling set of design decisions. I imagine that it was introduced to give the rondel more teeth, which is fine. You know, encourage a first mover advantage. But again, so seldom is it actually the first mover advantage. The advantage just drops from the sky randomly. Terminus. I get to play Hour of Need. Hour of Need was the final Saddler Brother Blacklist game using the modular deck system with the superhero theme. This is my third copy of Hour of Need that has gone through my hands. I acquired one in trade. Then I acquired a different copy in trade because it was more comprehensive and it had the missing expansion that I'd missed out on. Then I gave that to Dr. Stallone, figuring, oh, I've still got the first copy. I can go back to that one. No. I lost that one. Don't know where it is. So I had to get a third copy. It's available on Amazon. You can get all of Hour of Need on Amazon.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they have some leftover copies. Now, granted, whether or not that's funding a company that is now a shell of its former self that may or may not be involved in mendacious activities, I can't comment. But I do love Hour of Need. It is the most flexible of the modular deck system games in that you just have two actions. There's not a comparatively more rigid, well, you have a move phase and you have an action phase and you have a power phase. You just have two actions. You want to use a power, probably cost an action. You want to play a card, probably cost an action. You want to draw a card, probably cost an action. You're getting the vibe. And I do like how the different scenarios work. Now, the way the scenarios work can be a little bit more daunting than the way the stages work in, say, Street Masters. But so long as you pay careful attention to the accompanying documents that outline the different setups, they give you a lot more flavor to what's going on, a lot more context to what's happening, all very comic book type scenarios. So there's the very basic one, like a villain is robbing a bank, all the way to this dimension is shattering itself into many pieces and you have to go find the cosmic MacGuffins to go stitch it back together, you know, comic books. And I thoroughly enjoy all the modular deck system games, the exception of a police officer themed one. That one was just a little bit too much about movement for my tastes. But Hour of Need has much more spatiality than Street Masters does. Rather than just, I need to be adjacent to the thug to punch the thug really hard in the face, you do actually have a sense of scope in Hour of Need about going to different issues and being able to cover different bases, but without necessarily the overarching tedium of just schlepping yourself from one end of the city to the other that you found in the police procedural one. So I'm a big fan of Hour of Need. It's definitely got a lot of rough edges, but I'm glad to have it back. It plays very quick solo. All the modular deck system games do, because the boss just scales up in hit points based on the number of players you have. And consequently, four players tends to drag a little bit. Two and three, I find is ideal, but solo works very, very well as it is. It's a crying shame that the Saddler Brothers are not in the business of churning out more modular deck system games anymore. I would have liked to have seen them continue to iterate on the system, but as it is, between Street Masters and Hour of Need, and with the occasional delving into Ultra Quest, although that one is really starting to push the duration, I'm very glad to journey into their design paradigm. And so that is Hour of Need, that has been repatriated into the fine So Very Wrong About Games collection after various misadventures have deprived previous versions.
All right, I'm going to go through three games very quickly, because we've talked about them a lot, and it sort of dovetails into what we talked about last week, just games that you can scale. So when a group of children come over, and this allows me to scale the game down to retain attention span. So animal pawn animal, you can just use less animals, so the game will end quicker, either one way or the other. And animal pawn animal is a great hobby game where you're stacking these great animal meeples, trying not to knock them over, trying to get rid of all the animals that you have in front of you. designed by Claus Mittenberger. And Ghost Blitz, same sort of thing. You can just like half the deck. And then you go through half the deck. Whoever has the most cards wins when you're done. Ghost Blitz, we talked about enough.
I've never played Ghost Blitz with children. How did they find parsing the cards? They took to it right away?
The harder one they took to right away, which I thought was mind-blowing.
Wow.
Like, she was getting them sometimes before I was. Blew my mind. But then,
that's great.
But then when the other card came up where it depicted the actual shape, then...
Oh, that's fascinating.
It was very fascinating.
Do you have any theory as to why that is?
No, not off the top of my head.
Yeah, because when playing with I've played with adults a bunch of times, the one that's exactly depicted is usually the more straightforward one, but the process of elimination one is the one that throws them for a loop. That's so interesting.
I thought that's when I brought it out, I thought that was going to be the hardest to explain, but took to it immediately.
So. Well done, okay. Yeah.
And lastly, they had to play Green Team Wins, and it's the same sort of thing. Usually you take 15 cards, but then you can just take two of each category.
Yep.
And then you're playing a nice short game of six cards of Green Team Wins.
Emphasizing how arbitrary popularity is. So it's a valuable life lesson as well.
Yeah, it doubles down on how trivial.
I couldn't help but notice, though, on your calendar for recovery and physical therapy that you've scheduled me back for regular swirlies as of next week. Is that strictly
it's
necessary?
It's good upper body work, Mark.
I know,
and
but
it's that
there's no
that,
other...
That up and down, it hits certain muscle groups that it's...
Yeah. I just can't only swirl.
I can't... I've tried other things. It's just not the same.
All right. And you're sure this comes from your doctor, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah. I'll bring a note if you want. It'll be in crayon, but that's all he had in the office at that day. It'll be fine. It'll be all good.
Okay. If the doctor says so. All right.
And that was Green Team Wins, designed by Nathan Thornton and put out by 25th Century Games.
Huey and I were shocked and scandalized to hear that Dewey has not played either of the last two Spirit Island expansions, either Horizons of Spirit Island or Nature Incarnate. Now, normally we reserve our discussion of Spirit Island for Sizzler, which is the Patreon-exclusive show where we talk about Spirit Island, but we have not convened with Sidewinder to do Sizzler in some time, and Dewey very much wanted to play Spirit Island, and so we broke out and we all played New Spirits. I finally played Wounded Waters Healing, which is a spirit that is an angry bloody lake, let me put it that way. Crocodiles all the way down. And you have an option of evolving in one of two ways. You can kind of develop more towards the healing angle, or you can evolve more towards the beast angle. And I didn't know how beast-focused it was. I've played with Wounded Waters a number of times, typically with Huey playing it. And I didn't quite appreciate that when it's doing damage and when it's messing people up, it's mostly through beasts.
Is there a card that is Crocodile Tidal Wave?
No.
Fail.
But that... Oh. But there is a lovely... It's either crocodiles or alligators. I don't know. I can never remember the difference. Someone explained to me the difference, and I remember for half a second. I think it's something about the shape of the nose and their attitude towards water. Anyway.
One salt water. I guess if you can get some sort of connection with salt water and the name, then you might remember.
That in turn is parasitic on a distinction I also can seldom remember. When it comes to geography or the natural world, I'm not the guy to talk to. So I know that there's a difference between salt water and fresh water. Lakes are fresh water, right? Or lakes.
No, lakes would be freshwater, yeah.
Nailed it. Anyway, back to Spirit Island. And I'm always on the lookout for new and interesting token-based spirits if it involves manipulating strife, manipulating disease, manipulating beasts. I'm all about that stuff. It's one of my favorite mechanisms in Spirit Island to manipulate. And I didn't know that Wounded Waters Healing had much to do with tokens, but it's all about beasts and manipulation of beasts if you want to evolve it in that direction. And I very much did. And so we got to give Dewey the rundown on all the great new spirits. I really think the past couple rounds of spirits have been very, very solid. We still love the Horizon spirits. We were gushing over the Horizons of Spirit Island spirits. We love a number of the Nature Incarnate ones. I keep meaning to go back to some of the Horizon spirits, although it feels a bit like cheating because I'm not going to say that I've mastered them. That is definitely a gross exaggeration, but I feel like I've kind of got a sense of how they work, particularly my favorite one. Like, Eyes Watch from the Trees, for example, is a relatively straightforward spirit to play and suits my playstyle exactly. And so I still remember the first time sometimes you have to go a turn or two or a game or two with some of these factions and have your little aha moment. I think it was the first card play when I was playing Eyes Watch from the Trees. Like, oh yeah!
I was going to say, what if someone calls the cops, though? Right? Watch from the Tree, that's pretty creepy. Just saying.
They're friendly googly eyes, Walker.
Right, well, we need a rundown, Mark, because there's been some discussion, some debate on the Discord about the event deck in Spirit Island. So,
so I think
some listeners might appreciate sort of your feelings on the Spirit Island event deck.
I've seen some of the very, very strong opinions articulated therein, and I can understand and respect where they're coming from, and I can certainly understand that for many people it would feel like an especially frustrating curveball when an event hits you the wrong way. I will say that, generally speaking, I am fine with the event deck. It is not one of my favorite elements of Spirit Island, but I recognize its utility. Because if you don't have the event deck, things can become a little bit too deterministic and calculational.
I was about to say that everything else sort of warns you what terrain type is coming up, and you know exactly what happens when that terrain type comes up. So it's sort of all, you can mathematically sort of figure out what's going to happen.
Yes. And generally speaking, insofar as I have an opinion on the difficulty of Spirit Island, although I think it does a very, very good job at making you feel like you're in trouble and giving you a sense of tension, even when victory is assured, I definitely don't think that a salient criticism is that it is too difficult or too arbitrary, even with the wildest events in the event deck. I would further point out that there are lots of context in which the event deck is leveraged, the most salient and obvious being the case of the French slave colony, slave revolt. And so interesting things happen in the context of the event deck. I would further observe that, and this is not true of the comments in the Discord, but this is just things that I've seen other people assert about the event deck, is that the event deck was not constructed with the sense of carelessness that some people assume, right? Many event decks are constructed with a certain sense of carelessness. Many decks of cards are just done with, well, we've got 110 cards on the card sheet, let's come up with 110 things. Even a lot of really good GMT card-driven war games fell victim to that pattern for a very long time. It was very clear that this was the size of the production sheet, let's fill it up with a whole bunch of cards that seem okay. Eric Royce does not design games that way. He does not design decks that way, and I can assure you that a considerable amount of thought went into composing the event deck. That's not a reason to like it. You can still not like it. That's fine. I'm just saying that if you think it's too arbitrary, I guarantee you it's less arbitrary than you might feel it, especially given that it is pretty much the only area of randomness that you're going to encounter in a serious way in Spirit Island. Now, all this having been said, full disclosure, as per usual, the designer Eric Royce is a personal friend of mine, and I'm a big Spirit Island stan, have been for years since it was published. I am a hipster of Spirit Island. I was into it before it was cool. Those are my feelings on the event deck. Thank you for raising that issue, Michael Walker.
So we streamed this Saturday, Robinson Crusoe, Adventure on the Cursed Island. So this has come out with a bunch of copies. I hadn't played it. I did get the original, and I played it when it first came out a billion years ago. But then since...
A billion?
Yep. Well, okay. I looked it up. I thought it was longer. This says 2012. But I thought it was a lot earlier than that.
I don't think that's a billion. I think it might just be 12.
I'll check the math.
Okay.
And get back to you.
Okay.
Anyway, very long time ago. Since then, they've come out with a new fancy copy that I picked up on crowdfunding. And so I wanted to get it to the table, and it played out much like I remember, which I enjoyed. So it's a lot of punch in the face. Because there are at least 12 different things you can do. You need to do all 12 of these things, because if you don't, it's a punch to the face. And you don't have 12 actions to do these 12 things.
It's true.
So it's much like Pandemic, where you sort of want to get out ahead of the fires, but fires will still happen, so you have to put down all the fires.
Let me track this metaphor. These are fires that punch you in the face?
Yes.
Okay.
Fire, fist, fire, punching, face things.
That sounds very dangerous.
It's very dangerous. So, Robinson Crusoe, you're stranded on a desert island. You usually have a mission to do, and the first one you need is to build this giant bonfire, so you need a ton of wood for that. But guess what? It's cold, so you also need wood for building fires, or else you get punched in the face for being cold. You also need food to eat, or...
Punch in the face.
Punch in the face.
Got it.
All sorts of wild animals, and that's where the fun part comes in. I feel fun. Other players did not think was fun.
Okay.
So you'll draw an event, and it says, oh, while you're out gathering food... A snake crawled up your leg.
I remember that one, yeah.
So it's like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And then it says, I'll shuffle this card into the event deck. Oh, good, nothing happened then. Good, yeah. We'll just shuffle that in. Yeah, yeah. Everything will be fine.
Yes.
Everything's not fine, because when that card comes back up again, that snake, you know, ravages through the camp and kills everyone. But stuff like that. Need to do all sorts of stuff. Interesting things, sort of, you know, figuring out what's the most important thing to all sorts of different inventions that you can build in order to, you know, make your actions more efficient.
Can't have a game without crafting.
Gotta craft. Anyway, I will play Robinson Crusoe anytime. My type of game. Punches to the face.
Would you mind speaking about the new edition?
Well, the older edition had like just sort of wooden discs that you put out. Everyone has two actions, and a lot of the conceit of the game is you can put two pawns on an action and it will be automatically successful. They don't have to be both yours. You know, you could put yours out and someone could come help you with that action and then nothing bad will happen. Or you can just put one pawn and then you're rolling some dice and maybe bad stuff will happen or a little bit of bad stuff. So that's sort of like, you know, how are you going to decide to do things? The new edition comes out with, you have giant miniatures instead of wooden pawns.
I saw that. How does that interact with the stacking?
You don't need to stack them. They do come. You do need to have a sort of leader on that action, because if something bad happens immediately, it will happen to the leader of that sort of action.
Right.
So you have to put like a little red base on it or just know who the leader of that action is.
Okay.
I found that to be a little weird. I just thought maybe you just put one higher on the action just to show that there's, I don't know, any. We used the red base because it came with red bases.
Of course. Wasn't there also some elaborate plastic shelter or something?
There is. Throughout the game, you take wounds every round if you're not in a shelter. So you build a shelter, and then you can improve that shelter because the weather happens, and the better your shelter is, the better you'll survive the weather. So you're building roofs, and you're building palisades, like walls around your camp to keep out the animals. And this new edition has all sorts of different levels of that. So you slowly actually build up your camp. You put a little tent and then a little covered shelter, and it actually makes it more elaborate. You have this deluxe mega camp if you get it that high.
How functional is it?
Pretty functional.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad at all.
Good, I'm glad to hear it.
It comes with all sorts of other stuff too, like land. I think it's mostly to do with like the coolest thing I feel that is with this new edition is it comes with this, shouldn't say comes with, I think you normally have to buy it separately.
Right.
But it comes with this giant book of adventures. And there are a ton of extra expansions and stuff that came out, but all of these new missions are in this book of adventures. And if you have the mat, they actually have a spot where the book, it's a big spiral bound book. So it opens wide open. They have a spot on the map that it goes to. Every mission is sort of two pages. And so now it's part of the board. And there's like over 100 different missions.
Wow.
You know, King Kong attacking to cannibals, to zombies, to you name it. It's in that book and has like funky rules and all sorts of interesting stuff happening.
Because I do remember there were a lot of complaints when it first came out about the rule book and the organization, and there were some misprints, and it was a whole deal. And overall, the package was infinitely less usable than it could have been. And when I think infinitely less usable than it could have been, I often think of deluxe versions. But it sounds like they've done a pretty good job of both rendering it deluxe and making it more usable. Is that accurate?
Yes, 100%, because this edition comes out with not only the spiral-bound adventure book, but there's like a spiral-bound starting campaign book where you open it up and put it on the table and that is your game board. Like we talked about before, rule books that incorporate sort of like playing in the rule book. And that's right. What you do. So it moves you through the game, all of the different actions. As you turn the pages of the thing, you're placing game components in the rule book and it teaches you how to play.
I see.
Hands above. Yeah, so it's true. Robinson Crusoe was sort of the first poster child of the worst rule book. And then,
well, not the first, but it was definitely hard to overcome. It was a prominent one.
Then I think Star Wars Rebellion took over from that. Not that it was a bad rule book, just that it's so overwhelming to teach. And yeah, so still love it. Hope we can get back to it again sometime. But if this cooperative, you know, being beat down constantly is not for you, then probably Robinson Crusoe is not. But if you want to check it out, it's on our live channel, Robinson Crusoe, early portal game designed by Ignacy Trevicek, Ioana Kianka.
Yeah, she's involved in the revised version, I believe. She's been doing a lot of very impressive design work with Portal, and it certainly seems like the new edition has benefited from the decade or so since it was published. I remember enjoying Robinson Crusoe fine. I didn't quite understand the raptures that people gave it. I think it's largely because it benefited from being one of the earliest heavier co-ops, but it certainly sounds like this new edition is an iterative improvement, so I'd be happy to give it a shot. We finished our first campaign of Slay the Spire, the board game. I'd done a campaign or two before that, but this was first campaign with all of us together, and so we confronted the Act 3 boss, And we definitely gave it what for. I was playing the Watcher, and I very much felt like I was kind of the fifth wheel for much of the first two acts. I did not find that I had built a very good deck. It was bloated. It didn't synergize well. I could never transfer stances, which is kind of one of the tricks that the Watcher does. And ultimately, this kind of had a 180 turnaround with a couple of cards that got added to my deck. And leading me to, and this number won't make sense, I think, to many people, but I was, during the last boss, able to do a single attack that did 34 points of damage, which I thought was pretty good. And it definitely made me feel like I'd figured something out, at least, in terms of getting the character to synergize properly. And I definitely do think that playing with four players, as we were, really highlights the extent to which you can really leverage a lot of the standard benefits of a co-op game, because the vulnerable status, which doubles the amount of damage a target takes from its next attack, suddenly vulnerable is vastly more powerful than it would be in other contexts, because we had a number of different characters, actually, who could apply vulnerable, none quite so frequently as Walker, but... And then we would say, what's everyone's best available attack? It's like, oh, my best attack is 4. Well, I can do a 6. Okay, you do your 6, and now it's 12. And so our sheer damage output was, frankly, staggering. Our defensive capabilities, not so much. So it was a bit of a knife edge at the end. But we definitely had some good offense going on.
Yeah, there was a little bit of juggling in the very last second.
Yes. I believe both you and Huey were on the verge of death.
That's true. Yeah, I think Slay the Spire has a lot to offer. There is definitely a cooperative experience, like you just said, about the vulnerable, figuring out who has it, who can utilize it the best, sort of, even in the deck building part of it, because once I saw that that was powerful, I decided to shy away from other things and get more to help out the group in general. And also for the people and that's for people who have never played Slay the Spire. I think that there's enough of a game there and interesting enough to play.
Yeah.
And then for those who have played Slay the Spire, I think the sort of push back against as well, why don't you do it? You know, it's just doing what the computer game does, but and the computer does better. But I think there's enough nostalgia there and interesting stuff of how they incorporated those cards to keep those people interested. And the cooperative part of having other people with you on that journey, I think there's enough there for that as well.
Good to finish a campaign. We've now, I don't know why I'm doing it this way, but we are actually following the schedule of unlocks as represented in the game. I mean, it's your own game. You can tear open and add all the colorless cards right away if you want to, but we're awfully close now. And I'm continuing to enjoy it, although I don't think playing again I would go back to the same character. She didn't really speak to my preferences. I would probably go to one of my mainstays like the Defect or the Silent, but...
It did feel as though you were not enjoying that last session a little bit due to your character.
Yeah, it was a source of mild frustration just because I felt like the way that character works in particular is about balancing the fact that they tend to have a large number of actions available and then having to find a way to make that work properly, because it felt a unique kind of frustrating to have a large quantity of actions and never feel like I could leverage them properly. And so being action poor is generally understandable to me. It's like, oh, I've got 4 great things that I want to do and I can only do 2 of them, which is now obviously if you're too action starved and borderline skip a turn, we complain about that level of frustration all the time. But by and large, playing a game of Slay the Spire, I feel like I've got a list of things I'd like to do and I can only do a subset of them, as opposed to, well, I can do all these things. None of them really seem to matter. Okay, I do 2 damage and generate 3 block. Oh, I take 5 damage in the face. Great, great. No problem. So things did turn around, though, because I finally drew cards specifically that keyed off of how many extra action tokens I had. So the 34 damage attack that I did was do 3 damage per extra action token you had. I had all 5 because of a variety of other things that I'd had that I'd been unable to leverage properly, plus 2 because I was in wrath form, and then doubled because of vulnerable. So it worked out very well.
All this being said, watching other characters, because Ironclad, I only play Ironclad.
That's all you do. Are you going to consider playing?
Well, this is what I'm getting to. Watching how the other characters played out, it made me go back to the game and realize I hated the other characters still.
Oh, okay. I was thinking, did this cause you to reapproach the computer game and appreciate it at a different level? No.
Well, maybe. I decided to play the Silent because I liked the things that the Silent was doing. But realizing that you don't have that artifact starting where you heal after every fight is so brutal.
It's true. The Silent does not have all the advantages of the Ironclad.
He does a lot more damage.
She does.
She does a lot more damage than the Ironclad.
Well, they can. It depends.
But then it also brought into the fact that since I had not played any other characters, you get card unlocks when you play.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
So I thought, oh, that's kind of, you know, Brian, that brings back, you know, the old FOMO, you know, unlocking stuff, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I might continue.
Maybe.
On. Maybe.
Maybe. What about in the physical board game version? Would you be inclined to try?
Oh, I think it's much different. I think it's not as frustrating because you're working together, right? So I'd be more than happy to try another character.
Okay.
In the board game edition.
So Horizons can and probably will expand, just not necessarily as fast as I might have thought. There we go. So that's Slay the Spire, the board game. This was put out by Contention Games. They have Imperium the Contention with design credits to Gary Dvoretsky, who worked on the analog version only, and Anthony Giovanetti and Casey Yano, who are the people at Megacrit who did Slay the Spire, the computer game.
Since the slight theme of today is board games based on computer games, I'll skip ahead to Deep Rock Galactic. Now, I've talked multiple times on The Pledge of Indifference, which is our extra show that we do on crowdfunding, about Deep Rock, because when it came out, it looked gorgeous, has tons of miniatures, and just sort of an interesting theme.
If you like dwarves. I mean,
your sci-fi dwarves being set out on corporate missions to risk your life in order to mine minerals for profit. And so I saw it come up on the local sort of distributor, you know, out this week, and decided to pick it up as sort of like, this is what I get to do when I get home.
Sure.
You know, sort of like, you know, my treat.
No one would begrudge you.
Exactly. And I got to play it. And I played it much like, it's more one of those sort of dungeon delving type games. You play these interesting, I got just the basics version. So the dwarves are figures, but all of the monsters and everything else are cardboard standees. And so it flows very well. You have your three actions that you do. You move around, you shoot. All the weapons roll different colored dice, which is kind of interesting. They all have different special abilities as well. The monsters all have different things that they do to make them more difficult. And you got to sort of drill your way to get to certain parts of the map and use your sort of zip lines and or jumpers to get through to some. You break up stalagmites to get stuff. I found it interesting. The one conceit is as you roll all your dice, you get to assign them in sort of a chain, right? So you like can hit a bunch of different targets at the same time. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Oh.
I'm definitely going to go back to it. Tons of different missions, lots of expansions out for it already. Interesting stuff. There's like a campaign system where you can upgrade your skills and stuff. So that might be interesting. We'll see. This is designed by Ole Steinness and put out by Mood Publishing, another board game based on a video game. The video game is a first-person shooter where you're doing much of what I just said.
And you've played the video game, huh? Oh, you haven't?
I have not. It did go on like major discount, and so I proposed it to the group to like so everyone would grab a copy and try, but no one had any interest. I did look at it just the other day again, and it seemed interesting. I would play it if I knew people that played it. Not something I'd want to go with by myself.
Okay. Well, next time you try, be sure to play the stroke card real hard.
Will do. I'll guilt them into it.
Yeah.
Just so.
I'm just saying you should be taking advantage of that.
It's true.
We played Quartermaster General East Front. So Quartermaster General is a long-running series of games designed by Ian Brody and published more recently by Ares Games that we're big fans of. It started with Quartermaster General, which was the World War II version, six-player team-based. And now there is a Quartermaster General game for every player count from 2 to 6 inclusive. And I'll probably end up doing a segment on Bloat ranking my opinions on all of the Quartermaster General games that I've tried thus far. But this was the first time that we are taking the Quartermaster General formula and applying it to a two-player game. In the past, they have all been either team games or, in the case of Cold War, a three-player game, which is unusual given that most of the time historically themed war-ish games tend to be primarily two-player. So this was a bit of a coming back to the origins. And I'm not a huge fan of the Eastern Front as a setting for con sims or war games or even lighter games. But I am a big fan of the Quartermaster General system, and so I was keen to give it a try. In many ways, this is the most iconoclastic of the Quartermaster games because all cards are event cards. That is all they are. There's no different kinds. There's no economic warfare cards. There are no status cards. There are kind of sort of reactions that you play directly from hand, which again is somewhat unusual for a Quartermaster General game. And Most unusually for all the Quartermaster General games, units move by themselves. There's just a phase where every unit gets to move. Now, in practice, this isn't as consequential as you might imagine for things that aren't tanks, because you move before you play any of your cards. So it's not like you can clear out an area and then move in with your infantry. You can do that with your tanks, but not with your infantry. So that unit asymmetry was interesting. The ways in which it was more like a sort of vaguely more traditional conflict game were somewhat interesting. And most of my perceptions of Quartermaster General East Front were entirely drowned by the fact that I'd completely forgotten how frustrating I find it personally. This is just a me thing, to be on the offense. I was playing the Germans. The Soviets have their defense lines, and the entire tempo of the game, so many conflict games do this. It's like, you're the attacker. You're the driver's seat. You're the aggressor. You're in the driver's seat. The tempo of the game is exclusively determined by your actions. There is no game unless you force there to be a game. I'm not saying, just to be perfectly clear, this is not a design problem. In many ways, this is just evocative of what it is to be in the offense in a war game like this. It's just the war game that I play the most often is probably Combat Commander. And I play by the random scenario generator, and I'm always on the defense because I never, ever outspend my opponent. My conservatism leads me to be outspent, and so I always end up on the defense. This is just a happy accident. So consequently, I completely forgotten. So at turn one, I'm looking at the board state, looking at my hands, and I'm like, oh no. So it was an interesting adjustment, and by the end of the game, I think I kind of got a handle on it. But I will say this as a substantive comment again. There were a lot of cards that seemed to pop up near the end of the game that consisted of, hey, a unit magically shows up and it gets to attack right away. Whereas a lot of the other cards, the more staid cards, the slightly less surprisey versions, tended to be more prevalent in the early parts of the game, which is unusual. But it's hardly to be surprising because there's not a whole lot of staggering of the deck in East Front. Now, there are two decks. There's the mid-war deck and the late war deck, and use the mid-war deck during the first few rounds. But honestly, it just seemed a little bit strange how the dynamic of the game went in that in the mid part of the game, the Soviet defense lines crumbled and the Germans swept over almost all of southern Russia. And then suddenly the Germans run out of gas, which is fine because in Quartermaster General games, sides frequently run out of gas. And then the Soviet defense seemed to consist of units teleporting in from space and immediately launching counteroffensives. It was a little bit strange. Overall, though, I'm still a massive fan of the Quartermaster General system. I'm not 100% sure how I feel about this in comparison to the other ones. I like the team dynamics of the other Quartermaster General games, and I like the diversity of cards. That having been said, as a slightly interesting rift on a historical theater that I'm not a massive fan of, I think that Quartermaster General East Front was pretty successful.
I agree. I liked it a lot. I really like, it's like a weird, I like everything they kept the same, and I like everything that's different.
Sure.
And it focused solely on the Eastern Front. And what I mean by that is that there were so many other pressures from the West, and I think it could have been very interestingly represented in the cards, with the cards, like you said, and not had any, you know, Western troops,
right,
but sort of just had, you know, bad things happen to the Germans because of what was happening on the Western Front.
That's
right?
A good point.
And I thought that would have been an interesting tie-in instead of just solely having it centered on...
Well, a lot of war games do that, right?
Yeah.
Just in terms of a lot of Western Front games do that. They try to abstract away the pressures introduced by the Eastern Front. A lot of grand strategic games try to introduce the pressures of conflicts not modeled on the situation. And so that would have been an interesting possibility. But again, the Quartermaster General games tend to be pretty simple and pretty focused. And so I don't know how they could have done that in a trivial way, but possibly that would have been a way to get sort of a sort of parallel of the economic warfare angle, into play. So
Quartermaster General Eastern Front.
Probably more to follow. It was a little bit longer than I would have liked. It was a solid 90 to 120 minutes, which if I'm going to play a two-player game of that length, I think I'd rather it have a little bit more meat on the bone. But probably if a slightly more decisive and or comfortable attacker were in the driver's seat,
yeah, I think
it would probably expedite things.
It's one of the games where I think will play differently the more you know it. Not so much knowing what the cards do, because the cards, I'm not saying they're similar, but they sort of do what they do. And I don't think there's anything out of the ordinary, but sort of figuring out how that sort of two-phase movement works and how it interacts with the cards and other things, I think will change future plays.
I confess I do miss the status cards. I do enjoy the status cards. I felt they added a lot of flavor and some interesting tempo decisions because the opportunity cost of putting out a status card was often considerable. And so I enjoyed that consideration in other Quartermaster General games. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how East Front develops again. I'd like to play the Soviets this time and experience the magic of...
I don't think both players can play Soviets, Mark.
Well, then I guess we'll have a problem. That is Quartermaster General by Ian Brody and Ares Games, published in 2023. I have yet to try the revised version of Quartermaster General 1914, which I'm very eager to try. But so far, every time we've had exactly five players, and I've brought Quartermaster General 1914 to try to play it, either another person has showed up or someone has dropped out. So maybe someday. And those are the games we played last week. Now a brief break while we pay some bills.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we're back, and Walker is going to tell you about the news and why it doesn't matter.
Well, Gen Con, Mark, that means we have a ton of news.
Yeah.
Like, so many interesting things.
I'm looking forward to Undaunted. I'm looking forward to War Stories. I'm sure people not named David Thompson have some worthy projects at Gen Con. I just can't think of...
I have one thing. Cities by... Phil Walker Harding. Phil Walker Harding puts out some interesting things.
We enjoy Phil Walker Harding.
We
do.
Llama Land, Baron Park. Unfortunately, it is co-designed by Stephen Finn, who has put out the nightmare work that is Biblios. Now, that's a dig. That's a dig at you.
No, I think we should clarify this. We should absolutely clarify this. It is irresponsible, Walker, to malign the work of a designer when secretly what we are doing is trash-talking a member of Board Game Barrage. We don't have anything against Dr. Finn and Dr. Finn's games.
No, he's put out Narga Parbat, which I enjoy immensely.
Yeah, Narga Parbat was really cute. I enjoyed that, yes.
Cities is going to be put out by Devier Games, so there's two bonuses for there. We have Phil Walker and Devier together.
Absolutely.
It looks like it's another sort of place these things in certain patterns to score points.
I do enjoy a polyomino game, it's true.
It looks cool.
All right.
And non-Gen Con news... With the plane of Deep Rock and Terminus, I have my shelf of shame back down to one, which is the War Room. And like I've always said, which is fine. I enjoy looking up at the War Room and knowing that one day it might be played is enough for me.
Imperial Borders.
And it will be great.
It'll be something, that's for sure. And that is the news and why it doesn't matter. We now go on to our feature game, which is Wilmot's Warehouse. Wilmot's Warehouse was published by CMYK. It is available right now. And it was designed by Ricky Haggett, Richard Hogg, and David King, the former two of which were involved in the digital version. It was originally based on a video game called Wilmot's Warehouse, which I have not played, but seems to be a different kind of thing than the board game, although it has many of the same graphical assets. And we'll definitely have more to say about that later. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. And Walker, let me just point something out. During the period where you were gone, I definitely had, on occasion, discussions with people about various editorial standards, about various expectations that we have in an episode of So Very Wrong About Games. But I will tell you the one thing that they all knew about and they were all very keen to do. Everyone wanted, in your honor, to give an unhelpful summary of a game that we were talking about. Yes. So, Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Wilmot's Warehouse?
Well, Mark, you're putting out all of these tiles. In a standard game, you're looking at 35 tiles one at a time, and you're putting them all face down, so you're trying to remember where 35 tiles are on this grid.
Yeah, can we just stop and think about that for a second?
You can.
35 tiles are going to be put face down in a grid, and you need to remember where each of them are.
Exactly, and there's sort of abstract-y type art that you can identify as multiple things.
Yeah. Do you remember the game Nana?
No.
Where you're trying to form sets of three cards? Anyway, there's a 3x3 grid of cards that range from 1 to 9. I've played Nana a number of times. People forget what is in those cards.
We play That's Not a Hat Mark.
Yes.
And there's like four cards, and we can't remember what they are.
Yeah. And so when you initially hear the pitch, you need to be able to place one at a time 35 different tiles and remember where each of them are. It sounds, I'm not going to mince words, it's certainly, when I first started, it sounded impossible.
So you do this in five rounds of seven tiles, and then, and for the last four rounds, there's like a special ability or something that will pop up.
Well, it's special, but I don't know how I play an ability.
How I play Wilmot's Warehouse is that I try to remember maybe the first five tiles or so, and then just let everyone else remember the rest, because that's all I'm going to remember. just kidding, Mark. I can't remember five tiles. I feel as though Wilmot's Warehouse is a hard sell, because this is not the pitch that you should use, but it is the pitch. Would you like to play a real-time memory game?
Yeah, those are buzzwords that alienate a lot of people. And especially since we've, in our group, and the people that we've introduced That's Not a Hat to in particular, because That's Not a Hat is somewhat... alienating isn't the word, but it definitely leads with tension, and some people react to that negatively.
Well, I really feel Dewey would enjoy it if we had it, like we presented it.
Yeah.
And we presented it that way.
And he hates real-time games. We didn't even get to the real-time part.
No.
Because the real-time part is when you're actually solving, quote-unquote solving it, all the possible tiles, tiles are revealed and you have to associate them one-to-one. And what makes it sometimes even more daunting is that you're placing 35 tiles, but there's a total supply of 120.
150.
My apologies, 150. And so the vast majority of cards that you're going to be flipping aren't on the board, and people find that daunting. Yeah, Dewey noped right out when he just heard about memory. He didn't even want to hear about the real-time part.
It's true, but because I know he has a little bit of role-playing background, I know he's engaged in role-playing right now. And I think if we got to the storytelling part, which we haven't talked about yet, I think he would very much enjoy it.
Yeah, you're probably right. So when I describe it to people, I describe it as a cooperative memory storytelling game. I should probably leave out the memory part, because I think it's weird. It communicates a set of expectations that are strictly true, but somewhat misleading, because for years in the hobby, there have been a whole bunch of storytelling games. You know, whether it's the Story Cubes or iDark Overlord or Once Upon a Time or all these other things. And where they tend to fall apart as traditional hobbyist experiences is in, unsurprisingly, the gamification of things, right?
Or in the final end game. Yeah, scorification, I guess you could say.
Yeah, the gamification, the scorification, what have
end
you. The attempt to provide structure to the collaborative storytelling experience is one that I think is much better served through tabletop role-playing. Until Wilmot's Warehouse. This is the first time in the hobby that I've ever seen a game manage to gamify storytelling in a coherent, satisfying, and structurally sound way. And honestly, that alone is a kind of magic, which is a phrase I'm going to be repeating a number of times, because Wilmot's Warehouse is a kind of magic.
And before we lose all the people, because we've said timed element, don't stop the podcast yet. The timed element doesn't come till the very end. Once you've put out all 35 tiles, then you start the timer, and then there's another deck of 150 sort of cards that you separate into piles equal to number of players, and then however people want, they get to go through these piles and place the cards on top of where they think the tiles are, and you can move them around, and everyone does it as a group, and that part is timed. And once you think all the cards are in the right place, then you stop the timer, and the game will tell you how great you are.
Yeah, when I first read the rules, I saw that you're nominally given 5 minutes to complete this task, and I thought, take me at least 10. I don't know what's going on. And sure enough, not only was it the case that I was completely unprepared for how the storytelling would allow me to remember where all the tiles were, I was also unprepared for how quick it is. That resolution, you don't need 5 minutes. It doesn't take that long. The longest we've ever taken is 2.5. And I think over the course of We've only ever had a couple of times where we weren't 100% sure, and even then, if every mistake you make adds 10 seconds to your final tally. And I realize a number of listeners have pointed this out. Technically speaking, the term for the techniques that Wilmot's Warehouse use is memory palace technique. I this is a very personal thing. That is the legitimate term. I hate that term. I don't know why. So I'm familiar that that's what it's supposed to be called, but there's a reason why I haven't brought it up, because I don't like how it sounds. This is just, I'm sorry. It's a weird thing.
It's a common sort of, you know, developing your memory sort of technique.
Right.
It's great for advancing your sort of study techniques as well. That's why I already touted this as a great game for many things. You know, learning how to study better, learning, you know, against dementia and Alzheimer's and stroke recovery.
Absolutely. So again, a lot of this is leveraged in terms of the quality of the graphic design, because with a worse tile set, I don't think Wilmot's Warehouse would work nearly as well. This was one of my disappointments with Codenames Pictures, for example, because a lot of the Codenames Pictures are like just two things kind of mashed together. They were all just chimeras. Like this is a telephone with wheels on the bottom or whatever. And the Wilmot's Warehouse tiles, it really is striking how any given tile in isolation can usually be at a minimum three different things,
and
far more.
And completely different, not just like, you know, like a seed or, you know, a upside down seed. No.
Exactly. As an example for the game that we streamed, there was a compelling explanation for a given tile to be an egg, a cracked egg with the yolk and the white surrounding it. And then instead, it ended up being Rave Bay, a character who ended up being fleshed out considerably, and she ended up being Pope. So the way these things work is that not only do they derive meaning by virtue of the connection with other tiles, it's just that the tiles are designed in such a way that they are sufficiently clear as to give you a basis to operate on, but at the same time sufficiently abstract to let them form any number of different possible contextual connections. And so consequently, I think the artwork is darn near perfect. Like, treading that line of abstraction is a kind of thing that board game art has been doing ever since the days of Dixit, and probably even before that. But I really think that the design of Wilmot's Warehouse takes it to another level.
Yeah, the minimalistic, what's on the tile and the way they can be interpreted. Yeah, fantastic. So let's switch to these daily tasks. So at the beginning of rounds 2 to 4, you flip
to
over.
Five.
2 to 5. Sorry, I meant four left. 2 to 5.
Yeah.
You flip over sort of a work tile, and it gives you sort of like a little hook on how you're going to play this particular
round. Extra little challenge.
So fantastic ones. One's like, every time you play a tile, rotate the board 90 degrees. Nightmarish, I know.
Well, that's one of those things where in the abstract it seems like it wouldn't be much of a deal. But when we flip that over, which I think at the beginning of the second round of our first play, we immediately already understood how terrifying that was, because we had just constructed this very clear picture in our heads about where everything was, and that was just shifting all the time.
Yeah. Or get up from your chair and switch seats.
Same problem, yes.
Or put out a different whole line of tiles off to the side of the board and then memorize the order that they're in and then flip them all down, and that's sort of like a mini game that you could play on the side. All sorts of very interesting like that, and they come in sort of two difficulties, easy and difficult, and you get to, you know, tweak that how you see fit.
My favorite one thus far, I think, across all the ones we've had, is the one where the person who flips the tile can't show the tile to anybody else, but they get to say whatever they want. And it's a lovely little bit of giving a little bit more agency to the person flipping the tile, as well as this weird sort of panic at not knowing what everything looks like. Because you're not sure, the tile that I've seen that nobody else has seen, I don't know where that card is going to be at the end of the game when we all have to assign them. It could be in my pile, it could be in somebody else's pile. And so now suddenly it is less collaborative on one end, but it makes the end game more collaborative at the same time.
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic, because mine that I didn't get to see, they said it was a flower of some sort. So at the end of the game, I'm going through my deck. Well, that's kind of, is this the flower? Is this the one? Is this the one that was supposed to be a flower? So I'm like flipping all these cards. The one I liked so far was, it was flip the whole week over, which is 6-7 tiles.
Yes.
And you get to look at all those 7 tiles, and you have to memorize them a little bit, because you're going to flip them all back face down. shuffle them, and then put one on the board at random.
Yes.
And then through that day, you have to remember which ones are placed to try to figure out which one wasn't placed.
It's a separate memory challenge.
So you know that was the one that was placed at the beginning.
Process of elimination, exactly.
Crazy. Very interesting ways how they like sort of twist around stuff. So I'm looking forward to seeing some of the others.
Yes, and it's also a way to slightly finesse the difficulty. So we've been just playing at the standard recommended difficulty, which in terms of a competitive experience, in terms of a gameplay challenge, is technically too easy, but that's fine, right? It's a cooperative storytelling game. The fact that it's quote-unquote too easy ain't no never mind. It's all right. Even people who find, you know, base difficulty level of other co-ops too easy should probably have no, like, competitive urges to ratchet things up. Now, I'd be perfectly happy to try some of the ways to make the game more difficult. There are suggestions.
It's not the destination, Mark. It's the journey there.
No, exactly. But one of the ways that you can control it is by sticking to the hard challenge cards, or perhaps even increasing the number of tiles in a variety. I would be open to trying any of those things, especially because I really do enjoy the curveball that those challenge cards introduce.
So all in all, and I think it's a very easy teach, I know it will be a hard sell, and there are a lot of elements there that might be a roadblock, like sort of the storytelling part, as we've said before. A lot of people are just not into that, but I think this is a different kind of storytelling. It's a little more like a cooperative sort of...
And people just form the connections naturally, and that's just it. So, again, there are storytelling games that I thoroughly enjoy. Durant's Fiasco are some examples, more traditional tabletop role-playing as well. And for a lot of people, that is not their bag. They don't want to do improv. They don't want to have to bear the burden of contributing to this evolving narrative. But in Wilmot's Warehouse, I have yet to see anybody fail to make these kinds of connections between these graphical tiles. And that alone is enough of a spark. It's enough of a basis to then start spinning out the tale. And so this is the storytelling game for people who don't like storytelling games. Again, as you say, it might be a hard sell, because if you tell someone it's a storytelling game and they might have tried that in the past, or they hated D&D, or, you know, they find that very, very, very pressure-filled or strenuous. Everything in Wilmot's Warehouse, from the design decisions to the graphic design, which again wasn't original to the board game but nonetheless is there, seems so perfectly calibrated to produce this kind of magic at the tabletop. It's really a triumph.
I was about to say, you just cut me off, because I'm going to say,
Mark, I'm very sorry.
Mark, there's a magic there.
I'm sorry, Walker.
That's okay.
And I'm reminded a bit about what they were promising, CMYK, the publishers were promising when they were publishing Wavelength. And they said, you will feel telepathic. It will produce a kind of sense of telepathy when it works well. And sure enough, I'm like, oh, you know, it's another word association party game. We've seen tons of those. And Wavelength does produce that effect. It gives you a task that looks impossible, or at the very least, difficult to the point of being borderline arbitrary. And a couple rounds in, or sometimes even immediately, like, oh, wow, this really works. This is doing the thing. This is producing the social effect that the game is meant to produce. A whole bunch of people, critics, users, what have you, I find sometimes give games credit where they don't deserve it, or fail to give games credit they deserve, because it's not so much about the social experience you had while playing a game. It's about what the game did to facilitate or block producing certain kinds of social situations. Wilmot's Warehouse is a game that wants to have you tell a story or set of stories involving people, places, objects, etc., driven by but not entirely determined by the tiles you flip. And that is what it does 100%.
Yep. You start with the center tile, and that sort of is the basis of your first story. And then it could be something. And then that person or thing has accessories or things that boost it, or there's the destination you're going to,
or chronological narrative,
or in behind the tile is the things that happened before you got there. And it's like I said, there is a magic,
and every game produces its own logic, every game produces its own set of framework, and it's different from one to the next. My one concern after playing Wilmot's Warehouse a couple times was whether or not, when seeing the same tiles, because there are 150 tiles available in the game, and you do put out 35, so yeah, there's a lot of wiggle room there. But my concern was, every time Rave Bay comes up, is it always just going to be Rave Bay? No, it's not. I've seen, after having had such an indelible experience with one of the tiles being Rave Bay, when that flips up, I don't just see Rave Bay again. I don't immediately revert back to the other story. That tile, again, gets swept up in whatever set of narrative or narratives that we're constructing that time. And so the variety on the tile once again reasserts itself. So it's not just the fact that there's a big supply. It's that on any given contextual placement, the tile takes on an entirely new set of meanings. And that is one of the things that keeps me so excited about every set of Wilmot's Warehouse, because I have no idea what kind of story is going to emerge.
Yeah, and it's ripe for expansions. Like I said, we used to add more daily quirks, but it doesn't need them. I'm not saying that because, you know, you need it off the base game, but it's an easy upgrade.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you for deciding to spend the time with us. We hope to see you again soon. As ever, please do take care of yourselves, take care of your hobby time, and thank you, Rules Explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Medical Mutual wants to remind you it's almost time for Medicare's annual enrollment period. As a trusted health insurer for more than 90 years, Medical Mutual is here to help you find better Medicare benefits. Be confident you're getting the most from your Medicare Advantage plan. Schedule your free Medicare plan review today at medmutual.com/review. Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.